I was born in a small town called Masjid Suleiman in southern Iran.
I was born in Syria.
I was born in Hamburg, Germany.
I was born in Korea.
I was born in Tanzania in a refugee camp.
I was born in Singapore.
Guatemala. I'm from Ireland.
I was born in Thailand, refugee camp.
I was born in Mumbai.
I was born in Vientiane, Laos.
I was born in England.
I was born in Costa Rica.
Welcome to Many Roads to Here, bringing the voices of immigrants, refugees, and asylum seekers to a national conversation about migration and identity. I'm Celine Ross. For today's story, we traveled to the Kunar Valley in Afghanistan and Pakistan, where Nasrullah Safi grew up amid constant war and fighting between many different groups. In a land where resources were scarce and fighting was constant, many were persuaded to join the fight by promises of rewards after death. But guided by the words of his father and the dreams of his mother, Nasrullah followed a different path. Here is his story.
My dad wanted me to go to school and he wanted everybody else to go to school. So that's what my father focused on. Even though my mom never went to school, but she wanted her kids to go to school and pursue their dreams. She actually wanted me to become a medical doctor because she's been suffering from all sorts of illnesses. And she said, like, I would love to have you be my primary care doctor. My dad was a teacher, and he had seen so much in his life, like different regimes, different governments, and he focused on education. He was a smart man. He was a very smart man, so he did not believe in everything people said, not the mullahs, religious leaders, you know, who happened to have some sort of power, divine power, and they could do whatever they believed. The lesson that they taught us that don't listen to people, do not get trapped, because the preaching that they had for everyone, and there's going to be a reward if you do certain things, and if you go fight, you will go to heaven, you will go to Jannah, and there is going to be a reward for you. And as a young kid, you believe in that, especially in a place where you had nothing, right? So you don't even have any food to eat. On the other side, there's somebody telling you, if you die fighting, you will go to heaven. You will have streams of honey and streams of milk and streams of all sort of food or whatever you wish for, right? And my father, he said, no, like, don't listen to them.
Nasrullah's father wasn't just offering him the age-old adage of don't believe everything you hear. He was saving Nasrullah's life. In their hometown in the Kunar Valley, groups had been fighting constantly for generations. The Afghan communists, backed by Russians, fought the Mujahideen, backed by Americans. Extremists, Arabs, and Pakistanis came in and fought their own battles in these villages, too. Religious leaders called mullahs taught that fighters would be rewarded after death.
Well, so when I was born, the Russians were just driven out of the country. It wasn't peaceful back then. It was the Russians' invasions and then the so-called Mujahideen, what we call like the holy fighters, fighting the Russians. And they finally were able to kick them out of the country. And then the country turned into a civil war between those two different groups fighting for power. So it wasn't peaceful, and there was conflict, there was firefighting, there was rockets attack. We even call those rockets like blind rockets because there was no aiming, there was no target. It just became our daily routine because the fight can break out at any moment or any time. So whether if you were at school, you know, if you were at town shop, you had that mindset. Or if you're walking to mosque, or if you're going back to the house, you had that mindset that the fights can break out at any moment between different groups, people from Egypt or other extremist fighters from the Middle East. So they were fighting their battles in our villages. The geographical structure of the valley is naturally built for fight. Mountains rising on both sides, and there are tons of caves, there are tons of valleys, and it's right with Pakistan. Nobody could stop them there.
When Nasrullah was 7, the Taliban took over Afghanistan. They brought with them a promise of peace, but it was an empty one.
They came in, you know, in big trucks, wearing white and black robes, holding guns, and flying white flags with the words from the first pillar of Islam, La ilaha illallah Muhammad Rasulullah, there is no God but God, and Prophet Muhammad is the messenger of God. But, you know, everybody was so tired of fighting. So people was very optimistic, and everybody was very looking forward to seeing changes within the government or within the country. And it was the other way around, and it was totally the opposite. It was like a wild, you know, it was just part of their culture firing into the sky. This culture has been there for centuries, but the Taliban were firing into the sky. That was just part of their celebrations. And in our valley or in our village or in our town, if somebody would marry or there was a bird to a boy, people were firing into the sky because everybody had guns. They were firing. That's how they celebrate their daily lives. They didn't even think about like where those rounds were going. One of the biggest things that happened was that there was less fighting for a little while. But if you have a physical, like a physical peace, we did not have mentally, we're not stable, like we don't have emotional peace. So everybody was so afraid, you know, like they were so afraid, they were so scared. People had no right, had no power to say what they wanted to say. They had no right to say, like to their self-determination. Or if you see something that the mullah was doing it, that was not right, or somebody else who were affiliated with the Taliban and you were not agree with them, you know, like you couldn't say it, you couldn't talk about it. You could get beat up or end up in jail for days and being tortured. They banned girls from learning or going to school. They banned women from leaving their house without escort. Even some women had escort, they were caught, beat up, and sent back to their house. Or in some cases, you know, they were sent to jail without trial or anything. People realized that this is a very brutal regime who do not believe in basic rights for women. So I'm the youngest of the boys, and I have four sisters, and one of them is older than me, and the rest are younger. So we're very close. And every time that we were home, they were crying because they were not allowed to leave the house. They were afraid to step outside and face the wrath of the Taliban. And they were afraid. They were heartbroken. They were scared. They couldn't pursue what they wanted to pursue. So they were trapped in four walls.
Even though there were so many risks associated with speaking out against the Taliban, Nasrullah's father remained in opposition. He even refused to pray at the mosque because he didn't agree with the Taliban laws. In a land ruled by extremists, this made him a target.
They came to our house. So my father ended up going to the door, and he opened the door, and he saw those fighters, those guys holding guns, and without asking him anything, you know, they started beating him right away in front of us. And we were just standing there with my mom, even though she wanted us to stay inside, and we watched her. Like, you know, I watched my father, and I watched my mom crying, and I watched my dad with my naked eyes being beat up by the Taliban. I was hopeless. I was powerless. I was a young kid, and I was crying. That's all I could do was just to cry.
Nasrullah was just a little kid when September 11th happened. America was a faraway place he knew little about. In his village, the Taliban celebrated by firing into the sky and handing out sweets. They said Osama bin Laden was a hero. And then war came once again to the valley.
It was very soon when I heard the planes dropping bombs in different places in Corner Valley. One of the bombs fell pretty close by our village, and it shook our entire village, and it feels like an earthquake. And it didn't take too long for the U.S. military to take over, and they took over the country. The war started, and there was a lot of support because, you know, people were tired of the Taliban, you know, their brutality on a daily basis. So they wanted change so bad. So it wasn't like Taliban were gone and the U.S. military came in. It was a huge campaign going on in Pakistan and in other parts of the country and in Afghanistan. And there's like, like everybody ended up like, oh, we're going to jihad, fighting against the infidels, and there's going to be a reward. Yeah, there was no peace. There was no peace. No, not at all. When the first time I saw American soldiers were in our town, I mean, they give us candy. We couldn't communicate, but they were extremely nice. I was excited. I was fascinated. Even though I couldn't speak the language, I couldn't communicate with them. I was extremely impressed and fascinated about the support that they provide to our school. They would bring school supplies. They would bring books and pencils. I really wanted to learn English. I really wanted to communicate with them. Even though I couldn't speak the language, I always wanted to hang around. I could pick up a little bit, like, hi and what's up. That's all I knew back then. I spoke with my parents and I spoke with my older brothers, and I said, I wanted to learn English so bad, you know. were able to find somebody who happened to be a farmer. I started taking English classes with him. We couldn't afford to pay tuition or, you know, pay for classes. So I had to work at his farm after school, and he would teach me a few words every day, and then like 5 words, and then 10 and 15 and 20. We didn't even have books. So he would write a few words, and that's how I started learning a little bit.
Like many before them, the Americans brought promises, but no peace. Even though they opened up a school so girls could keep getting an education, Kunar Valley was still a dangerous place.
Americans would come during daylight, and then the extremists would take over. You know, like at night, it couldn't go to anywhere. It couldn't go in any village, or it could, because you never know what could happen to you. There were still a lot of bad people, so still a lot of bad guys around. You know, the former Taliban, because the Taliban just did not disappear or did not go into the ground and disappeared. You know, they were farmers during the day, but they were Taliban at night. So you never knew who the Taliban were, but they could do anything to you. So my best friend, we're going to school together. His family worked in the regional capital where there was a military, US military base. One night, the Taliban came to their house and killed everybody. They brutally killed them. And the word was that they deserved to be killed just because they were spying for the Americans. But it wasn't true. They worked for the local government. But the Taliban thought that the family members worked for the Americans because that's where their job was, where the US military base was. So it was horrific. And that's when we decided to leave, because I could speak a little bit English and I was always hanging out around Americans, and my family, like, we had to leave because we are next. We didn't have much time. So we rented a truck and we took whatever we could take with us, and we left for Jalalabad, which is about like 50 miles south of Kunar Valley. Like, I don't exactly know how old I was, around 14-ish. So my uncle was there, but it was a struggle. It was a journey that we were not prepared for. We were not used to life in big cities. There's a lot. You have to pay rent, you have to pay bills, you have to pay your electricity and all sort of bills. And we were not ready for this. We were a simple family with a rural background. That was it. My father was a teacher and he was a farmer, and we're spending our days farming, helping my parents. But when we moved to Jalalabad, there was no farming there, and there were so many vehicles. The house was fancy, unlike the one we had in Kunar where I grew up. We had electricity for the very first time. We were not ready, like, we're not prepared for this life. Sooner, my brother figured it out, and he opened a tea shop. Just like a coffee shop, but it was totally different because it was a samovar out in the open. It was raining. I was standing there, and my brother was standing there. We didn't have shelter. It was a samovar to boil water, cups, kettles, trays, sugars. That's all we had, and that's all we needed. So I was going to school in the morning, and in the afternoon, I would help my brother delivering teas door to door and asking people if they wanted tea.
Delivering tea often brought Nasrullah into strange situations with customers who sometimes asked the teenager inappropriate questions. Plus, there was a different job he was interested in. American soldiers were deployed throughout the city, and like in Kunar Valley, Nasrullah was fascinated by them.
I asked one of the interpreters, how can I get this job? And he looked at me. I was pretty young too, but he didn't say anything about my age. But he said, like, oh, you have to speak very good English. You have to have good English knowledge to become an interpreter. But they do hire people. You know, that's where you need to go if you speak very good English. And that's when I started thinking about becoming an interpreter. So one day I skipped the school and I told my mom I'm going to school. As usual, she kissed me on the forehead, said, have a wonderful day. I did not go to school. Instead of going to school, I ended up going to one of the military bases. It wasn't too far, so I had to walk down there. And I showed up, and I said, I wanted to get this job. I wanted to become an interpreter. But I didn't know that you had to be 18 to become an interpreter. I wasn't. And I returned home, heartbroken. I said, I'm going to try it again. So the birth certificates is basically handwritten papers. There's no record. There's no digital record. So anyway, so the next time I went back, I went with a different birth certificate, a fancy one. And it shows, and like, I'm like, oh my gosh, I wanted to get this job so bad. It shows I was 18 and I got the job. I can't tell you how excited I was.
Nasrullah's brother warned him not to tell the rest of the family. They still had dreams of Nasrullah becoming a doctor, and they wouldn't approve of him being an interpreter. Nasrullah was just 15. He didn't fully understand the risks of his new job. He was just excited.
I didn't know that I was going to become part of those daily battles and firefightings and ambushes and IEDs, you know, improvised explosive devices. I did not know the risk. I ended up going back to Kunar province, and which was one of the most violent places. So we went through some training there. I was too young, and I still struggled with English. I could communicate a little better, but I couldn't understand the accent. Talking to American soldiers with different accents, it took me a long time to understand everybody. It's not like, you know, the English where I learned with this farmer. It wasn't like that. And then slowly I learned. Then I was able to communicate very well with the Afghans. But at the beginning, it was hard. And also when you were too young, a lot of folks don't believe in you because you're just a kid. Like, whatever. So, you know, in some cases, they wanted to tell you everything because, you know, you knew you were the only bridge between or the connections between the Americans and them. For me, it was kind of easy because I was from the same area and I could understand the different accent, the different dialect, and the different code words, you know, they were using. So I could understand everything. I was born in Kunar's. I could understand their actions, their body language, and what they were up to because I was from there. That really helped me. It was the same conversations over and over again. Like, can you please tell them, like, we need this and we need that and we need school and we need hospital, we need clinic, we need routes and we need, like, that kind of stuff. Like, the first few days, I would tell you, like, I was more excited getting in those trucks, those military trucks, or, you know, like, flying in those helicopters than thinking about the risk. It was very scary. When I learned, like, we got into firefighting, ambushes, I saw my own death. I found myself almost killed or seriously wounded on so many occasions. There was like 99.9% chance that outside of the wire, we're going to get shot at or we're going to encounter enemy ambush. I was there with soldiers 24/7. We eat together. We were doing pretty much everything together. We were in this together. So we're playing cards. That's how we improved my English. I was with soldiers 24/7. We became very close. Because I spent more time with the soldiers than with my own family. I was gone at the age of 15, probably younger. And then I grew up with soldiers at those military bases and basically on the front line.
Though Nasrullah found family and support among the soldiers, they were always in danger. And back home, his biological family constantly worried for his safety. So when he learned he could apply for asylum in the U.S., he began the process.
When I started working with them, my unit really wanted me to get out of there. And they says, we'll get you out of here. Because I remember they said, you're going to die here. We know this for sure. My mom still tells me, like, I was a very healthy person. But right after I went to work as an interpreter, the constant thoughts and stressing and depressions that, you know, I've created throughout years that while you were gone at front line, because I never knew what could have come and what's next.
After a year of military service, Nasrullah was eligible to apply for a special immigrant visa. He gathered the required letters from his chain of command and completed the extensive paperwork. He submitted the application package, and then he waited.
You know, some of the officers told me, we'd love to help you. You know, we were trying to get you out of here, but we had a meeting and we talked about different interpreters and their experience. And we realized that you're the only one here longer than anybody else. And you know the cultures, you know the local traditions, you know the norms, you know, like the most importantly, you know the terrain very well. You know every single village here, you know the mountains, and you have very good relationship with the local populations and local government. So that kind of like, you know, we try to help you, but then like we need somebody here for our soldiers too. But I promise, you know, do we get you out of here.
Nasrullah had been working for the Americans for 6 years. Finally, he got the news he had been waiting for.
It was 2016. And I got the email, finally, said you got approved. And I was so excited, I couldn't believe it. I didn't want to wait any longer. My family didn't want me to stay longer because things were pretty bad. I lost family members before that. I lost, you know, my brother-in-law and his son, my oldest brother was hit by a bomb, and he still carry more than 20 shrapnels on his body. And the trauma, I wouldn't talk about his trauma and the PTSDs and other mental illnesses that he suffers on a daily basis. And then my sisters got shot. So no way my family was ready to lose another family member. I flew in from Kabul to India, and I was there for some hours. And then from India to John F. Kennedy Airport, New York. And then from there, I ended up going to Texas to reunite it with my best friend, whom I was with him at the airport many, many years ago, to say goodbye with him, and thought I would never see him again.
After settling in Massachusetts, Nasrullah planned a trip to Beaverton in Oregon to meet a fellow interpreter he'd served with.
I lived on a small island called Martha's Vineyard and doing construction work and tree work. I had a round trip, I was going back. And then when I came out, it took me to a bunch of places here, and I visited a few places. I was like, oh my gosh, I think this is the place where I need to live. I was going back, but he changed my mind, and I ended up living here. I ended up going for a few hikes, and one of them was at Silver Falls. Like, oh my gosh, it does look like where I grew up. And looking at those caves, that's where I was when I was as a young kid. That's where we're playing. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is it. This is my village. It does feel like home a lot. Willamette Valley does look like where I grew up. Beautiful mountains, the trees, the green.
But a war doesn't just stop after you leave the front lines. In August of 2021, when Nasrullah heard the news about the Taliban taking over, it was a nightmare felt from the other side of the world.
I thought I was dreaming. I did not believe that it was really happening. I woke up, get out of the bed, and the phone started ringing nonstop. I thought it's a joke. I thought it's not happening. Not in a million years I would have thought that this would happen, but it did. So I was shocked. I was heartbroken. I was so scared. When I was working as an interpreter, I found myself almost killed or seriously wounded. But like, I was more scared when I heard about August of 2021, because I was constantly thinking about my family, because I lost, you know, already lost family members, and I still suffer and I still feel the pain. It's like, what would happen to my family? Because now everybody know that we work for the Americans. Everybody know that I was an interpreter. The Taliban went after my family. They already targeted. Where are they going to hide? Where are they going to go? I was lost. At words, I did not know, I couldn't think, and just looking at my phone to see that something's coming. That's gonna tell me like somebody broke into our house and they killed everybody in our family, just like they killed my friends and his family when we were in Kona. So that's what I was going through, the day I would never forget. My family, there's no work that they can do. They're scared. Their house was ransacked and searched a couple of times, and everything we had in the house are gone. The pictures we had, the documents, anything we had there, they're all gone. My family burned them. They're scared and then living in hiding. They never knew what could happen to them and what can happen to them and what future hold for them. There's no mental peace. People are so scared. There's no peace. People are like, they can't even go to sleep. I've been in contact with so many soldiers. Just we became one family. Until today, we're in contact and we constantly talk. And after, you know, I guess up 2021, so many were like hundreds and hundreds of them reach out. Just wanted to make sure I'm doing okay, my family's doing okay, or if there's anything they can do to get my family out or help them get to safety.
The Americans' withdrawal came as a horrifying shock. For 20 years, they had been a constant presence. And then with little announcement and no warning, they left.
So if you were to ask a teenage kid what they think about Americans when they were in Afghanistan, would they ever leave Afghanistan? So they would laugh like, no, that would never happen. Even the Afghans did not never believe that the Americans would come home one day. But most importantly, the Afghans were kept in that way. And they were never told what was going on. And the support was gone. There was no air support. And everything was pulled back from the battlefield. It just happened. Nobody was ready for this. Nobody was ready for this. The Afghan forces were not ready for this. And they just saw like, we're going to leave. for folks who supported American soldiers or other organizations within the U.S. government, or they were part of the missions that they endorsed for many, many years, they are being left behind to the mercy of the Taliban. For those who worked, you know, who were interpreters, I know so many people that they were interpreters. They're still left behind with their families, and they're scared. They don't know what can happen to them. They can't work. They're scared because everybody knew that they were interpreters. I feel betrayed. I feel sad. I feel upset about it. The greatest brotherhood that you can find is on the battlefield. That's how I feel about soldiers that I work with. We became one family, the interpreters and the soldiers, and the bond that they created is unbreakable. Like, they were so close. And they say, you join, you sign up for the military, and you say that I will never leave my comrades behind. And then the people who were with you 24/7, who were part of every single missions and operations and in patrols, they were the main, like, they were the people, like, those were not possible without their support, are now left behind to the mercy of the terrorists who would kill them, because the interpreters were considered the eyes of the Americans. They were traitors. And they were saying that, I remember myself, that let's get rid of the interpreters, because if there's no interpreters, then the Americans can't do anything. That's exactly what's happening to those folks. Afghanistan right now become a yesterday news. Nobody ever talks about it. If it's being brought up to any government officials, they don't even talk about it. They think just waste of their time. We're hoping for the best, and we're hoping for a lasting peace, but it doesn't seem like it. Same thing, girls and women are banned from going to school and learning. They're not too optimistic about everything that's happening. And they're fed up with everything, and they're very tired of everything that's happening right now.
Nasrullah's family is still trapped in Afghanistan. In a region characterized by decades of violence, hope is in short supply. Thousands of miles away in Salem, Oregon, Nasrullah now works with refugees.
I really like it. I love it. Sharing my own story, sharing my own struggle with others, and to let them know that they're not alone in this struggle. Because there's a lot of change happening when you go into a new country, when you go to a new place. And I said, well, you're not alone. You're not the only one. I have gone through this, and we are in this together. I promise everything's going to be all right. Everything's going to be okay. Those hard days that we have or you have right now will never last forever. And because I had gone through this, I had the same experience that you do right now. And I, you know, that confidence that they get makes them happy. And that's what I love about my job.
There is one hope that Nasrullah hasn't given up on: becoming a doctor, just like his parents wanted.
My hope is still there. It's still living, and I'm trying to, and I'm going to school. I'm almost done with my degree. I'll be done this year, and then I will see what happens in the future. But I wanted to do for something happens to my mom. She's been sick for a long, long time. Before something happens to her, I'm hoping I'll give her the news. Mom, I made it. I promise. And hopefully I will see her sometime in my life and help her. Now I'm a doctor, and I will help you. The dream is still there. The hope is still there. And I'm very optimistic about it. And I think it will eventually happen. It will be a matter of time, but I think it is happening.
Many Roads to Here is a production of The Immigrant Story. This episode was produced, edited, and hosted by me, Celine Ross. Audio post-production done by Greg Palmer. The original interview was conducted by Shankar Raman in the fall of 2023. Thank you to St. Andrew Lutheran Church in Beaverton for the use of their space to record the interview. This episode is a part of a series exploring the stories and experiences of Asian Americans. It is produced as part of the Oregon Rises Above Hate Coalition and made possible by a generous contribution by Anne Nato Campbell. To learn more about the Oregon Rises Above Hate Coalition, visit OregonRisesAboveHate.com. For more stories, visit theimmigrantstory.org/manyroads. Listen live at prp.fm or stream us wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.